A lot of reporters.
I was told to put this in. It's not mine. I was just told.
Oh, really?
Ready? Welcome. Shalom Aleichem, thank you so much for coming. And 5 months ago, February 24th, Russia began its most recent invasion of Ukraine. Feelings erupted, social media erupted, political reactions erupted. It was only the most recent invasion of Ukraine. Russia had been there before and since. Russia's most recent war with Ukraine in many senses began in 2014, a good 8 years ago. And there was an incursion, and there was another incursion, taking pieces of the Donbass and other pieces of seizing other property, other pieces of real estate from the Ukraine. But for some reason, this time it really struck a global chord in a way it had not before. And you tended to get very sharp, unified opinions. There were a couple of countries, there were a couple of groups that were maybe Russian sympathetic, we can say. The majority of certainly Western opinion was strongly anti-Russian and strongly pro-Ukrainian, and these sort of at least simple shows of solidarity with Ukraine became ubiquitous all over social media. And we know all of that. And yet, if we read the news with a little more nuance, we read the news with a little more context. Look, there are those who say, what do we need to get involved? This is not our war, this is Ukraine, why are we supporting them? There are those who contend that it's a corrupt country, why are we sending money there? And the many others who contend, we stand with Ukraine, and that's the way it is. And the truth is, there's more nuance to both perspectives. It's facile to say, this isn't our war, this isn't our concern, we're just going to stay in our own isolationist Alaramas. Because the last time someone said that in Europe, the last time we tried to ignore an incursion of a larger country into a much smaller country, it bears frightening parallels to Neville Chamberlain's attempt to appease Hitler. And there's certainly what to be concerned about from a layperson's perspective, that if we let Ukraine fall without the West pushing back, Russia will keep steamrolling west. So to say this isn't anyone's concern, but the Ukraine is facile and shallow. At the same time, for a Jew with historical consciousness, to say that I absolutely support Ukraine every which way perhaps betrays a lack of awareness of where so many Ukrainians stood during World War II, and it tended not to be with their Jewish neighbors, to put it very mildly. But it's so often the case that we don't think about all the angles because, you know, things are presented as sound bites, and you hear a quick opinion, and you hear rah, rah, rah. We sort of jump on one bandwagon or another. And to just jump on one bandwagon or another, it's a shallow way to live. And it's also sometimes bespeaks a lack of appreciation of who we are, what we are, and what we bring to the table in terms of how we see events, how we read the news, and how we can seek to make decisions and impact events. And I want to turn attention to another topic that's been white hot in the United States public square. I'm sure all of you are, unless you've been living under a rock for the last couple of months, I'm sure all of you are well aware that this past season The Supreme Court handed a number of very impactful, United States Supreme Court handed a number of very impactful decisions. Legally significant, constitutionally significant, and practically very impactful. Perhaps one that attracted more controversy and more political focus than any other was Dobbs. In 1973, the Supreme Court found in a case called Roe v. Wade, often just referred to as Roe, the Supreme Court found, and found may be appropriate in multiple senses, the Supreme Court found the constitutional right to abortion. A woman has a right to abortion, and they read that into the court in 73 saw it, read that between the lines of the Constitution, and if it's a federal constitutional right, then no legislature, neither federal nor state, can override that. And that had been pushed back over the time, over the decades since. It was reaffirmed in Casey, and then almost a month ago, on June 24th, 2022, the Supreme Court, at the very end of this season, the Supreme Court handed down Dobbs versus Jackson, in which the Supreme Court overturned Roe of almost 50 years ago. The President's Supreme Court found that there is no constitutional right to abortion. There's no constitutional prohibition against abortion. But the majority of justices found that the Constitution doesn't really speak to abortion. And like any other open issue, it's for state legislatures to determine, and for the people to determine by petitioning their legislators, by voting for legislators going forward, what each state will find in terms of the legality or criminality, potentially, of abortion at various stages and under various contexts and so on and so forth. As again, if you haven't been living under a rock, you probably noticed there's been a lot of excitement, a lot of focus, a lot of energy, an enormous amount of political controversy. You've probably read a fair amount in the news, however you get your news. You've probably read a lot of very impassioned opinions. Perhaps you even read a very impassioned, maybe even extreme opinions in both directions. You've probably read things like, this is the greatest Supreme Court decision of all time. You've probably read that the Supreme Court is outlawing abortion. Neither of which, maybe the first is a matter of opinion, both are very extreme. Both don't necessarily seem to speak to the issue. And no doubt that many of you have heard shiurim, and maybe some of you even came here thinking you're going to hear a shiur about the sugya. And there is certainly a halachic sugya of abortion, as there is about any human endeavor. Halacha has plenty to say about abortion. When yes, when no, why should it be aser, what the basis is, what the nafkaminas are, like any other area of life. There's a sugya, there's what to discuss, there's a rich machlokas rishonim. But that kind of conversation about a halachic perspective on abortion, I imagine is probably not very interesting to many of you. Maybe because, I won't ask for a show of hands, I will. How many of you, for how many of you was there a shir in shul over Shavuos about halachic perspectives on abortion? Show of hands. Oh, okay. How many of you, now let's broaden beyond abortion, beyond Shavuos. How many of you have had a shir in shul over the last 2 months since the political leak in May about halachic perspectives on abortion? Okay. Well, together. Put it together. I would say roughly afterward. So maybe you already heard this year. You heard this year in shul, you heard this year in school, or you had the opportunity to decline that year. Maybe you're not particularly interested in constitutional issues. You're not particularly interested in federal law. Or maybe you're not interested simply because this is a room of largely celibate teen men for whom abortion is not immediately relevant. For some reason or another, that's not perhaps what most of you came to hear, a halachic treatment of abortion. We certainly could have that. And I actually want to talk about something which I think is more interesting and a lot more practical, something which touches many, many aspects of life. It is maybe in a certain sense one of the central topics, it's not the central topic, it's not to talk about halacha l'maisa. I think what the abortion, a side piece of the abortion controversy, brings us to a central topic in hashkafa l'maisa. We'll introduce them to the story, a conversation. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Lamed Test on 39a, tells about a Talmud Chacham who was having a conversation with a faith leader of a different religion. Ahu Amgusha. And Amgusha is probably a Zoroastrian priest. Zoroastrianism now is a relatively tiny religion, as world religions go. But in the pre-Christian era, Zoroastrianism was spread across the Middle East. We go back to just by way of reference, just to give a frame of reference, during the days of Yeshayahu HaNavi, towards the end of the Bais Rishon period, there are historians who believe that Zoroastrianism was the most popular religion, certainly in the greater Middle East. Every once in a while, of course, the Shas will come across the Amgushi, the Chavre. A Zoroastrian priest is having a conversation with Talmud Chacham. And he said, let me tell you something about my religion. I believe in two gods, translating Aramaic as Hormiz and Hormin. We won't get into the original Persian. Hormiz and Hormin. And he says, Hormiz controls the top half of the body, Hormin controls the bottom half of the body. The good God, the top half of the body, from the diaphragm and up, the upper parts of your body, the elevated parts of your body, my heart, my lungs, my brain, my eyes, my ears, so the classier, more sophisticated parts of my body, digestion, excretion, reproduction, from the diaphragm and down, that's the domain of the other God. That's Hormin's domain. A belief in two gods. We talk about that every single day. Every single day. Raise your hands if you said Kriya Shema with brachas this morning at Shacharis. Mm-hmm. Raise your hand if you were in shul by Baruch Hu. Fantastic. Baruch Hashem, far more than those who heard a shir over the course of shulis. Amazing. The first words, the first comment we made after Baruch Hu, the first comment in the public tefillah, we bless HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he is, we borrow this phrase from the 45th parak of Yeshayahu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a Yotzer, or Ubore, Choshech. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who creates light and creates darkness. Oseh Shalom Voreis HaKol, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes peace and he makes it all. A paraphrase of Yeshayahu. Why the light, the darkness, and the peace? What's with peace? Why are we stressing the very first thing we say after Baruch Hu is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who creates light and creates darkness? What we're saying, and this is the perfect introduction to Kriya Shema, because the main focus, the first topic of Kriya Shema, is one God who created and rules the entire world. We reject the idea that there's a good God and a bad God. Pagans looked around the world, and a lot of things didn't make sense. We see good things happen, we see bad things happen. And daytime is a comfortable time to be around. If you're out in the dark in the night, it's a little scary. We look at the human body. We said there are parts of our body that we're very proud of, the parts of our body that we're not so proud of. There must be, how do you make sense of this? So many contradictions, so many conflicts. So the pagan approach was, there must be two gods. Simple solution. There's the good guy and the bad guy up in the heavens. There's the good guy and the bad guy. A Hormiz is the good guy, the good God. Hormin is the bad God, the God of light, the God of darkness, and that explains everything. And life is this continuing conflict according to the pagan approach. Life is this continuing conflict between the good God and the bad God, and we're just sort of stuck in the middle. So sometimes the good God is in charge, sometimes the bad God is in charge. We're this sort of like, we're the pawns, we're the pinballs. We just sort of get bound, we're the ping pong ball that gets bounced back and forth between the clash of divine titans. That was the pagan approach. Yeshayahu got up and reformulated what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us in Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. There's one God who runs everything. The spiritual, the physical, it's all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This idea was captured in that Gemara we started discussing a moment ago, so I had it on the test, with the Amgushi, the Zoroastrian priest, who at the time that they were the primary formulators of this idea, this dualist idea, this apikorsis, that there are two gods, a god of light and a god of darkness, He says, so Adam Gushi is telling the Talmud Chacham, you know, the top half of your body, that's the province of the good God. The bottom half of your body, that's the province of the bad God. And that's why people are so conflicted, because two different gods made you. So Talmud Chacham responds with the, take the girsa, the different girsos in the Gemara, the girsa of the Gra. Talmud Chacham says, that's really funny. So you're telling me that there's a spiritually oriented God, and he created my spiritual part, my heart, my lungs, my brain, my eyes. And then there's the God of physics, the evil, dark God of physicality, mm-hmm. and he controls the bottom half, food, excretion, reproduction. Real strange. Where do you eat food from? Through your mouth. Isn't that strange? You think like there's a war between the top half and the bottom half, and two different gods created. Isn't it strange that the top, you know, the upper God allows food to pass through to the bottom? And the Amgushi is left speechless. In other words, the Maharal explains, isn't it obvious that there's a single system? Isn't it obvious there's a single God who created the whole picture? Sometimes we see how it works together, sometimes we don't. You might be thinking, well, why is this relevant to me? Some religion from 2,000-3,000 years ago, some conversation that this now dead religion had with Amor, what does that have to do with me? The answer is it has everything to do with me. It has everything to do with me. And I'll show you right now. There are a lot of issues where there's a perception that there's, in the Western public square, that there's, you know, the religious approach, and there's the secular approach. Sometimes loosely conflated without getting into the politics thereof and how accurate this conflation is. There's the right and there's the left. So for instance, you know, there's this perception out there that, you know, there's the Republican approach to abortion, there's a Democratic approach to abortion. There's, loosely speaking, the right wing and the left wing, the anti-abortion and the pro-abortion. And the Republicans are anti-abortion, and Democrats are abortion on demand. And that's sort of the image you have out there, and you know, you have two choices. So pick one, pick the other, pick your position. Now the truth is, the halacha has a lot to say about abortion, as I said before, and it doesn't necessarily line up neatly with either position. It's clear that halacha does not believe that abortion is mutar under all circumstances. That's certainly clear. At the same time, it's far from obvious that abortion is only mutter b'makom pikuach nefesh. There is a rich sugya, rich machlokas harishonim, and most rishonim seem to have an in-between position. It is an iser, it's mutter in certain circumstances, not necessarily either extreme that you'll find in the sort of binary public square, it's A or B, it's right or left. But why not? And we often assume, well, you know, there's the religious position, there's the secular position, so, well, we're religious, so obviously we should choose a religious position. But maybe we should be a little more precise. There is the Christian approach, and there is the secular approach. Perhaps more, even more specifically, the Catholic approach and the secular approach. We're neither, proudly. We are utterly not secular. We are utterly not Catholic. We don't begin with the two positions that the Western world presents us and say, okay, well, which one is mine? We begin proudly with the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a Torah that gives us guidance on things that are obviously religious and ritual and the entire rest of life. Torah gives us guidance. There's a sugya. The same way there's a sugya about what's a kosher shofar in Rosh Hashanah, a sugya that so many of us are exploring right now. The same way there's a sugya about how much you owe if you do damage to someone else. The same way there's sugyas about honesty, and sugyas about marriage, and sugyas about karbanos, there's sugyas about everything. There's sugyas about abortion. We start internally from the Gemara, from the Rishonim. Let's figure out what we hold. Afterwards, we can check, okay, does our approach happen to correspond to one of the approaches in the public square, or are we in a third position? But we should reject the false dichotomy. A dichotomy is when you're presented with two options. It's either A or B. Often in life, dichotomies are false. Often in life, what looks like a dichotomy is a false dichotomy, because what looks like, well, I only have two options, it's really a lot more nuanced than that. An abortion is a simple example of how Western thought, Western public square presents as though it's a dichotomy. You're pro-life, you're pro-choice, you're pro-abortion, anti-abortion, whatever terminology you want to use, when in fact it's a false dichotomy. There aren't only two options, and we shouldn't even be beginning with the options of Western public square. And now let's come back to that story, that encounter between the Talmid Chacham and the Yamgushi. Who cares about Zoroastrianism? There used to be a pagan religion that believed in two gods. Okay, so if you're interested in history, that's fascinating. If you learn Masechah Sanhedrin, it's important to appreciate what the Gemara is saying. No. Yes, if you're interested in history, it's fascinating. Yes, if you learn Sanhedrin, it's important to know what the Gemara is saying. And yes, you all ought to be learning Sanhedrin, Daf Lama Tes Amud Aleph, because that is at the core of all of this. Because Zoroastrianism, you know, Christians tell a story about how there were three magi, the same word as Amgushi, there were three Zoroastrian priests who they believed were present at the birth of Yashka. What that story definitely captures is the following truth. Whether they were there or not when he was born, I have no idea. It doesn't really matter much to me. What does matter is a historical, a very important historical appreciation, which is that idea that used to be popular as Zoroastrianism, that there's the good God and the bad God, and there's this ongoing conflict, became a part of Christian thought. Zoroastrianism as a religion sort of faded to the background on the world scene. But Christianity, in most of its forms, picked up that idea. They renamed it a little bit. It's God and Satan. And there's this understanding in a lot of standard Christian thought and a lot of Christian literature, like Milton and like C.S. Lewis, that there's God and he's in heaven and he wants everything that's good. And then there's Satan, Satan. And he's sort of in the basement, he's in the netherworld, and he's a sort of like semi-autonomous power that's fighting against God and wants to ruin everything. A renaming of Hormuz and Hormun. It became God and Satan. And these two powers are struggling for superiority and struggling for dominance, and God wants the spiritual, and Satan wants the physical. And that essentially, the Christians kept that idea of Zoroastrianism alive. And why does it matter? Because if I ask you, here's another dichotomy. If I ask you, so, what's your approach to physicality? What's your approach? How comfortable should we feel with enjoying a good meal? How comfortable should we feel with having a good time? As a religious person, I might be very comfortable having a good time. As a religious person, how should I feel? How comfortable should I feel about intimate pleasure between a good wife? So, a lot of these questions may make us a little uncomfortable. And I might say, yeah, sounds exciting, pleasure is wonderful, but as a religious person, I feel sort of conflicted. Because, and sometimes it gets like a little fuzzy, not really sure what my perspective is. It seems sort of nice, but doesn't seem, somehow, religion isn't really one, you know, we should be spiritual, not physical. Where do those feelings come from? Because, and this is far more lemaisa for many of us than the abortion question, but the same basic structure. Because Western thought presents us with a dichotomy. The religious position and the secular position. The secular position is, you know, nothing means anything. You know, whether it's secular humanism or a more extreme type of bohemian approach, but basically, you know, there is no, fundamentally, there is no spirituality, and everything is just amoral, and, you know, if you want to enjoy it, and that's basically all there is to it. The religious approach in the Western public square is what seems like the opposite. No. You need to be spiritual rather than physical. Physicality is fundamentally bad. You know, sometimes, okay, you're going to have to eat, you're going to have a family, but basically, that's all taken away from true spirituality. That's the position, if you think about it for a moment, that is maybe, if we're honest with ourselves, we often think in terms of those two approaches. Yeah, that sounds about right. Like either there's a secular approach, and just do whatever you want, enjoy whatever you want, and there is no ultimate meaning to anything anyways, so if it feels good, do it. Then there's a religious approach, which is all pleasure is ultimately guilty. And all physical pleasures are the opposite of spirituality. And it's an either or. Okay, you make concessions. But fundamentally, it ought to be spiritual and not physical. If that sounds familiar, but those are in the Western public sphere, and it's reflected not just in the books that you don't read that are on your reading list of school, but it's reflected in the way news is presented all the time. So the issues are reported all the time. Great people talk about issues online all the time. It's a false dichotomy. And it's not secular versus religious. It's not left versus right. Maybe it is left versus right, maybe not. But it's definitely not secular versus religious. It's secular versus Christian. The secular approach, if Rachman Tzlan, one does not believe in God, so then ultimately there is no transcendent spirituality. Life just is what it is right now, so if it feels good, do it. Amoral, not even immoral, amoral. There is no ultimate morality to try to be nice to other people, but fundamentally, you know, there is no spirituality. So just the physical is all that there is. The other approach, that physical and spiritual are automatically in conflict, that's the Christian approach. That's the Christian approach that was picked up from Zoroastrianism. That there's Hormuz and there's Hormuz. That there's God and there's Satan. If Rachman Litzlan, one believes not in no gods, but in two gods, that too is a bodhisattva. And that's going to lead to this assumption that, yeah, in other words, are you living with the spiritual God or are you giving into physicality? And the assumption that, you know, never the twain shall meet. It's an either or. And that's why there's so much Christian guilt about pleasure. That's why the Christian approach to Eitzad, the Christian rereading of Eitzad Das reflects this. That's why the Christian approach has been for so many centuries that the ideal spiritual person is the celibate priest. Who isn't even married. Getting married is a concession. It's a b'dieved. Okay, most people lead b'dieved lives and get married, but the Christian approach has traditionally been l'chadchila, celibacy is the best. Super l'chadchila, for centuries of Christian thought, was that monkhood, the hermit, is the holiest of all. The more removed you are from physical living, the more holy you are, because they saw the physical and the spiritual fundamentally either or. You can't have both, of course, because it's rooted in an understanding of pleasures from Satan, pleasures from the lower god of darkness. We reject that fundamentally. We say every morning, we believe neither that the physical means nothing, nor that the physical is opposed to the spiritual. We believe instead that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the entire universe. There is a Satan. He too is a creature of the Borei Olam, as we learn in Sefer Iyub. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a universe, a complex universe, in which we are meant to be challenged, to have opportunities to make real choices, and to thereby earn our Olam Haba. This is the Olam HaNisayon. Olam HaZeh is the ultimate arena of challenge. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates an incredibly variegated universe, all sorts of excitement, all sorts of distraction, all sorts of different situations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the Yetzirah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted us to be challenged and have the opportunity to rise above. The physical is neither spiritually meaningless nor spiritually negative. It's spiritually potential. I can do it well or I can do it poorly. I need to choose how I'm going to live. When the Rambam speaks about this, in the third chapter of Hilchos Deos of his Mishnah Torah, which is devoted to the question of how a Jew understands physicality with sophistication and spiritual nuance, he contrasts us with Kamare Edom, with the Christian priests who don't see our position because they are fundamentally dualists. Because that Gemara in Sanhedrin of Lamites is alive and well at Ayom HaZeh. And it's capturing that we are neither secular, nor are we Christian. And so often Western thought presents us with that sort of false dichotomy. as though it's like, it's this or that. It's secular or religious, really it's secular or it's Christian. There were, going back a couple of centuries to the era of Galileo, there were scientists who saw a world without God, and there were, the church saw a world without scientific method. And that led to the assumption that it's reason versus faith. That led to it's the Catholic Church's oppression of Galileo that largely led to the assumption that, you know, either you're religious or you're scientific, you can't be both. But it wasn't the conflict between science and religion, it's the conflict between science and Christianity. We're neither atheists nor are we Christians. We are proudly Jews. We have a Masorah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He gave us a Torah. He gave us a perspective on how to make decisions and how to live. So this is, we began by discussing the need to read the news and to read events with open eyes. Number one, as we saw in beginning to consider the coverage of the war in Ukraine and the talk about the war in Ukraine. The first step is just to think, to consider, and not just to absorb whatever is told to me with the greatest gusto. To actually think things through, and to think things through with nuance. And to think things through with a perspective of, how does the Torah guide me? How does the Torah, what perspective does the Torah give me in terms of the categories of thought and how to put this together? And as we saw in considering the issue of abortion, it gave us an example of one of the common errors of thinking that we often make is to sort of just buy in to the Western dichotomy of Christian and secular, called loosely religious and secular, when it's often a false dichotomy. There's often a third way. And fundamentally, we start from within. We start from within and we work our way out. We start from, how does the Torah guide me? Halacha uva agada, in terms of practice, in terms of hashkafa and attitudes, and take it from there. And then figure out, with a confidence of being anchored in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, we can then impact the world around us. And I'll leave you with a blend of halacha lamaisa, hashkafa lamaisa, that captures specifically this issue of the physical, balancing the physical and the spiritual, and perhaps also reminds us that there's so much meaning behind even small things. The first half, Shulchan Aruch, is broken into four sections. One of those sections is Yoredeya, and the first half of Yoredeya is consumed with the halachas of kashrus. It starts with a heavy-duty hayeshech d'enamel, checking for trefos, meat and milk, a lot of heavy-duty sukkahs. Deeper into the discussion of kashrus is one little siman, Kuf Chav, chapter 120 in Yoredeya, devoted to what looks like a little detail. Based on psukim in this week's parasha, and one of the last mishnah of Maseches Avodah Zarah, Shulchan Aruch tells us the dinim of Tevilas Kehilim. If I buy food equipment, it used to belong to a non-Jew and now belongs to a Jew. It's made out of either metal or glass, and it's used directly to consume food, to prepare food, to store food, in direct contact with food. There is a mitzvah, probably a mitzvah d'oraisa, to be us kalim. Before you use that blender, before you use that chef's knife, take it to the mikveh, immerse it in the mikveh, and then you're ready to go. And then you can use it. Okay, I did. This week's parasha. Parasha Shavuot. Mishnah at the end of Maseches Avodah Zarah. Okay, important to make sure that happens. It's beautiful in the sense that you do it once and you change things for years. And I told that knife once, and every time I use a knife, I'm aligned with the mitzvah of Tfilas Kehilim. But it looks like a small detail, and it is a small detail. Small details often carry a lot of big meaning. There's a fantastic comment of the Talmud Yerushalmi. The end of Maseches Avodah Zarah on the Sugya Tfilas Kehilim, Perek Hei Halacha Tevav, quoted by the Beis Yosef, Yosef Karo, in Simin Kuf Chav. Shalmi says, what's this Tfilas Kehilim all about? What? taken from mikvah. I understand maybe if they're non-kosher ingredients, you got a kashrut, but this has nothing to do with, this may have never been used before. The mikvah doesn't remove non-kosher flavors. Why are you taking it? I understand people go to the mikvah. Why are you taking your mug to the mikvah? Why are you taking your fork to the mikvah? Shalmi says, often, typically, a mikvah, tefillah b'mikvah, is a cleansing process, spiritual cleansing process. A person or an item used to be tameh, you go to the mikvah, now you're tameh. You've removed the tumah. You remove the negative spiritual state. But sometimes, the Kohen Gadol goes to the mikvah, Yom Kippur, five times. He's not tahar. He's not tameh, rather. If he was tameh, he couldn't even walk the base of Mishnah to begin with. He wouldn't be eligible. Going to the mikvah again and again and again. Why? A non-Jew wants to convert to Judaism. A key part of the process is going to the mikvah. Why? There's no tumah that he's removing. Matter of fact, min ha-Torah, there is no concept of tumah until one is Jewish. You're not. What are you doing? The answer is that's not a tevilah ha-netaharis. It's not a tevilah that removes tumah. It's instead the other gesture. It's a tevilah mikadeshas. It's a tevilah that endows kedusha. The Kohen Gadol raises his level by going to mikvah repeatedly. The non-Jew seeking to become Jewish will endow himself with Kedushas Yisrael by going to the mikvah. Says Yerushalmi, you take your pots and pans, you take your forks and knives to the mikvah, it's like a gerus. You're converting them. Now your kalim are, now I'm going to eat off, drink my coffee out of a Jewish coffee mug. A Jewish coffee mug? Like there are corny Jewish jokes on the mug. What does that mean? Means the most profound idea that we've been talking all the way through. And it wraps together everything we've been talking about. We don't believe that the physical has no meaning, and we don't believe that the physical is anti-spiritual. We believe that the physical done right can be an expression of our spirituality. I don't just eat food. All human beings eat food. As a matter of fact, all members of the animal kingdom, all life, plants also need to eat. Anything living needs to eat. It could be neutral. You eat to live. Kadosh Baruch Hu gives us the opportunity to elevate my eating. Even my eating is an expression of Kedusha. I'm going to eat like a Jew. My forks and knives, my mug, my pot, it's going to be a Jewish pot. It's going to be something that's endowed with Kedusha. That's the opportunity that the Torah gives us to see guidance, even in the smallest details of Torah, guidance that gives us perspective on how we see all aspects of our lives. I wish you much hatzlach. I both say thank you so much. Have a marvelous evening. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.